Today is July 3rd, 1997. My name is Tim Hansen, and I welcome you all to the session. I'm glad that you took some time this afternoon to come and be part of this conversation. Martin stressed during the lunchtime announcements about how this isn't your typical session where someone is just going to give you a bunch of information and then you get to chew on it and go away. But this is more of a dialogue, more of a conversation, and Holden has been a safe place for people to express themselves, respecting one another's differing views. We all have different experiences on a number of different issues, and especially concerning gay lesbian issues. And so we want this to be a safe place where we respect one another, where we challenge ourselves to be open to listening and trying to hear what people are saying and sort of where their thoughts come from. So the group is different. I do the session every other week, and sometimes there's just two or three of us sort of kicking back and talking. Other times we have 40 to 50 people sort of in a room. So I have to sort of adjust how we do it each time. Sometimes we go around in a circle and sort of give people a chance to introduce themselves a little bit. I am an openly gay man. I've lived here in the village for about 2.5 years. Before coming up to Holden, I lived in Milwaukee, Wisconsin for 7 years. And I was a social worker there, working mostly with homeless families in the inner city. But I also worked for a couple of years with people coming out of prison, with folks in minimum security prisons. I grew up in Lakeville, Minnesota, which is about 30 miles south of Minneapolis, a small farming community. Grew up out in the country, a large family, mother and father, and two sisters, two older sisters, two older brothers, and one younger brother, 18 nieces and nephews, and there's just a bunch of us all around. After graduating from high school, I went to Winona State University, where I majored in undergraduate work in psychology and in speech and theater arts, and a minor in sociology, and then that took me into the social work. Sort of how it all works, I suppose. And now I'm the fire chief here at Holden, so just never know. I think that having these opportunities for conversation are a vital part of not only Holden's ministry, but the church's ministry. It took me a long time to come to terms with my sexuality, with my being gay. It was a very long struggle that didn't provide me with much opportunity to talk to other people about it. I didn't speak the words that I thought that maybe I was gay to another human being until after my freshman year in college. So I was 19 at that time. But I knew that I was gay from my earliest memories of realizing that I was a sexual being. A long part of that struggle for me was reconciling that I was a Christian and that I was gay, and that those terms didn't contradict one another, because I had certainly got a lot of messages that they did. I want to share some of my story, but I want to do that in the context of questions and sort of comments that come up, so this whole session isn't me just telling my coming out story. But I want to be very available to talk about my coming out story. I can only speak for myself. I can't speak for all gays and lesbians. I can speak for myself, and I can share my story. And I can perhaps share some perspectives from other people's stories that if I think it fits into the dialogue. So I just want us to feel comfortable to have an exchange and to speak openly and honestly with one another. And I think we'll start that by maybe just sort of scanning the room. I won't ask that everybody perhaps speak, but I am curious to hear different people's experience with gays and lesbians. If you have family members or friends, or this is always an interesting way to start, actually. How many here know someone who's openly gay or lesbian? Okay, most everybody. How many people here know someone who's gay or lesbian? Everyone who said openly is gay. I didn't say it was the opposite way around, sorry. My point being that just because someone isn't openly gay or lesbian doesn't mean that you don't know someone who's gay or lesbian. I can say without any hesitation that you all know someone, folks, that are gay and lesbian. there are gay and lesbian folks where you work, in your church, in your family members that are gay and lesbian. And perhaps the challenging question is asking, why don't you know them? Why don't you know all of who they are? Why are they not comfortable being open with you? And then that sort of brings the responsibility back to ourselves. Even if we have differing views, there's still a question of how we present ourselves that help people to be honest and express, you know, who they are and have a conversation with us, being honest about their relationship or their family dynamics and that sort of thing. So the scanning of the room, I'm just curious is if some folks could maybe share maybe some questions that they have or what drew you to this conversation this afternoon, and if there's some things that you'd like to share, you feel compelled that you need to share, to just go ahead and do that. And I think I'll just leave it as broad as that to start with and just encourage us as a group to sort of intermingle in that way, talk amongst ourselves. So just go ahead and jump right in.
I guess I'd like to talk a little bit about why there is such a hang-up, why people are so afraid of it. You know, you read all of the statistics now, and if we believe scientific fact, why it's been validated that it's something that people are born with, and it's who they are. And so why is our whole society so hung up on it? Why can't we get over that hurdle and go on to other things?
There's been a lot of scientific research done in this area, and I don't think anyone would say that they're 100% sure. I mean, there probably are lots of people that would say that, but there's a differing sort of research, and the spot where most people sort of come to comfort is saying that it really is a mixture of biological or genetic factors along with societal influences, social influences. I would say that I was born gay, and the societal influence that I received perhaps could have, well, and did successfully suppress my being open and honest about who I was for a long time. So in a more accepting family setting or community setting, I may have been able to express myself earlier and come to more healthy terms with my sexuality. In a family setting or society that suppressed the gay lesbian issue even more, may have been, quote, successful in getting me to pretend or act as though I was heterosexual and get married and have kids and deny the true orientation of my being gay. I think it's an issue because it's new for a lot of folks who've chosen not to think about it for a long time. It's different. Sometimes folks think, you know, I can't relate to what it means to be gay or lesbian. Well, you don't have to understand it or to talk about it more. And I think it's also related to just the hang up about sexuality in general. I mean, our church certainly isn't real successful in talking about sexuality. And I think many folks don't know a lot about sexuality, and that causes a discomfort talking about anything that either has the word sex in it or that creates images in their minds when they think about sexuality. I'm not going to respond to every question like that, and don't let me. but yeah, other feedback about that?
Well, sort of touching on that is, you know, I don't personally care anybody's sexual preference, you know. Nonviolent and loving, I don't care. So I've lived near Portland, Oregon, and there are some pockets of gay community there. And they've been under siege in Oregon because they keep trying to pass measures to do all sorts of things to gay rights there. But what gets me, and it sort of touches on that, is that if my wife and I are walking down the street and I see a gay couple, so what? You know, big deal. But some friends of mine will be offended if they see affection between same-sex couples, but think not the same of a heterosexual couple. And when I'm with my kids sometimes, some of the heterosexual couples I see get pretty hot and heavy. It's like, you know, pull them away, you know, especially at the beach or something, like, get out of there. And so I guess like you see the affection between people, and there's a different reaction when it's the same subject, you know. And I'd just be like, throw that out there, to see if anybody thinks they've had that experience or something.
Response back?
Kind of like with that, I mean, like how you said that some same-sex couples, you see them more affectionate in public, and I don't think that it's just that group. I think that, you know, people that are, you know, opposite sex get like that in public too. I don't think it's based on one specific, is that what you were saying? Or?
No, I'm saying the reaction to it.
Oh.
You know, I mean, if I see a couple of women holding each other intimately or kissing, so what? But I've seen people react harshly to that, where they wouldn't react harshly to heterosexual kissing and hugging and squeezing and stuff like that.
You get sometimes that difference between, okay, I've read about it, and my brain says, okay, I'm comfortable with it. You know, we don't even talk about it anymore, I'm so comfortable with it, by the way. And then suddenly to see it, and it bypasses the brain a little bit and stirs a little more something else, and then like, whoa. But I agree with you. I think that public affection has its limits, and sure, whether it's same sex or opposite sex sort of reaction. But I think that that's part of the reaction that folks sometimes have when it comes to same sex couples.
I also want to say something else. As far as I know, a bunch of the states are working on passing laws for same-sex marriage and stuff, and my own personal opinion is that I don't know why it has to be voted on by anybody, because nobody voted to say that straight people can marry, you know, other straight people. So I don't understand why it's such a big deal, the world's gonna fall apart if that happens.
It's a legal relationship, and that's the significance of it. I'm a lawyer who does a lot of divorce law, and so when a man and a woman get that marriage license, there's three people at the altar. You know, the husband, the wife, and the state. And so then they determine legal rights and responsibilities from that. And then when they divide, you have the protections and safeguards supposedly of the law. So in the same-sex relationship, it expands liability for insurance companies and expands the cost of those relationships. And the institutions that would bear them, the major employers, the insurance companies, they're some of the forces behind not accepting them, because they don't want to deal with the cost of it.
But it has nothing to do with, in that situation, it has very little to do with the preference of the people running the insurance companies about types of relationships. It has to do with pure dollars.
Right.
Pure dollar issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the money issue.
Yeah, completely.
Social Security benefits for surviving partners.
Yeah.
You were going to make a comment, perhaps before you brought us to same-sex.
I was just reflecting on it. It seems like there's a continuum from absolute heterosexual to absolute homosexual. And my personal experience is that there's not very many people at either end.
Mm-hmm. Glad that you brought that up. That's part of Kinsey's research back in the 50s.
Yeah.
And Kinsey's research suggested that this idea that we've created that people are either heterosexual or homosexual, one or the other, that's it, is perhaps wrong. One book that's sold in the library, or sold in the bookstore, is called Heterosexism. And it talks about the creation of these terms. These terms, heterosexual, homosexual, are only a little over 100 years old. That we began this urge of having to box and classify people. McKinsey's research suggests that there's a scale from 0 to 7, and I always get mixed up which is which, but I think 0 might be heterosexual and 7 might be homosexual, and that all of us are on a spectrum somewhere on that scale, and that there are very few that are exclusively homosexual, that all of their experience, desire, thoughts, attractions are exclusively homosexual, and the same would be said for heterosexual. But that we all have some degree of variation within that. Some people might find that very freeing. I had a dream once about a guy, and I think that I'm gay. And I actually had someone come up to me in a session last year. He was pretty aggressive towards me during the session, and then I wanted to engage in a little more conversation. And after about an hour and a half, well, what I discovered was that this guy finally was comfortable telling me, well, I remember when I was a teenager, I had a dream once about a guy. That doesn't mean I'm gay. And you think it means you're gay? Well, it doesn't, does it? No, it doesn't. You know, it means you had a dream once about a guy. But I think lots of times our fear and our anger, that our anger is motivated with that sort of fear, like, oh my God, that must mean that I'm gay, or someone's gonna try to tell me that I'm gay. No, that we're human and that we're sexual beings and that we have thoughts and we have dreams and attractions, and so that we're on a spectrum. And that, in fact, some folks may move along that spectrum a little bit, but usually not from any great extremes, but, you know, have different variety.
And I'd add one more piece of support to that, a sense of union. Psychology would say that there's both a masculine and a feminine piece of every person.
Right, right. But if someone doesn't have that information or is fearful, the homophobic, they're fearful of even the whole concept, and they're developing a close relationship, if the person is female, developing a close relationship with another female, that maybe there's a little bit of an attraction there, but of course you'd never act on it. You know, I'm happily, you know, she might say, I'm happily married, I have no interest. But that could, perhaps even spoil the friendship. No, we can't even be friends. Oh, no. Rather than just saying, wow, that's interesting, isn't it? That's not threatening, that doesn't challenge my relationship with my husband and, you know, or my relationship with my friend. But sometimes that's maybe a little more comfortable with women, but guys get really hung up on that. But hopefully we're also moving along with that sort of understanding.
So can people move from one to the other? So is there sort of a choice? Because I've read or I've seen a program about a religious group, church, who had a program to rehabilitate people who were gay or screwed up or deviating or too, you know, wrong, and so we're going to put you in a program to change you. And some people, and they do.
Right.
So
they act like it's a disease. It's not a disease, it's the way you are.
Until 1984, 85, that was actually a psychological diagnosis of DSM-2.
Mm-hmm. Actually, until 70.
Yep, it's part of the
disease. Yeah, until it was revised, and it was 80 or 83 or 1.
What was it?
DSM-R3.
It's a way of defining abnormal psychology prognosis, diagnosis.
Diagnosis usually should be a diagnosis.
I believe it was in 1972 when the American Psychiatric Association removed homosexuality as a deviation or as a mental illness or something strange like that. So actually any psychologist or counselor that would try to counsel someone out of being gay would be going against their certification and their licensing, their national organization that supports them. It's no longer, you know, viewed that way. Now, your question about whether people can move, say if someone's a 2, could they move to a 6? No. You have situational things. Our correctional system, our criminal justice system, puts men locked up with men and women locked up with men. Now, people may engage in sexual experiences with one another then. And that's more situational than it is perhaps at a core of who they are. So that would be perhaps a big change. The idea of ex-gay ministries is interesting. I sort of toyed and played with that idea in my own years of fighting against my being gay. And I went through a phase where I felt that I was healed from being gay. That the group that I was with said that it was that I was possessed by an evil demon. And so through laying on of hands and speaking in tongues, that demon was cast out of me. And so therefore I should have been healed. What I can tell you, what I experienced for the following 6 months was not a change in my sexuality. What I experienced was a suppression of my sexuality. I just felt that I was a non-sexual person. Didn't mean that I stopped having the feelings or the thoughts, but every time I did, I felt so incredibly guilty that there were times, this is while I was traveling around Europe, the group I got involved with was in England. There were times where I would literally get off a train, set up my tent, and spend the next numerous hours praying and with my Bible because I saw someone on the train that I looked at twice because I thought he was cute. And I was like, oh my God, it's a demon. or thought that that person's a demon sent from Satan to tempt. That's who it is. That's what it is. As soon as I was away from the quote pressure or support of that group, everything was the same for me. But even in the midst of that experience, I don't even think that I could have been able to sexually perform with a female, but, you know, to then live, quote, a normal life, a heterosexual life. So many folks that engage in that, I believe it's more of a suppression of their sexuality, which is sad, because our sexuality is a gift. It's a gift from God. It's part of who we are.
So they're muttering, you know, so they do maybe change somebody outwardly, but it's not
right
permanent.
Right. And what it does for the inside turmoil of trying to come to terms with who they are, who they know they are, is interesting. One of those organizations is called Exodus International, if you may be familiar with. Interesting story that the two gentlemen that founded that organization eventually became long-term partners. Left the organization, expressed their love for one another, and left the group. I always challenge people if there's those that think that, you know, that can work. That could work. Someone could go in and be cured, and you were heterosexual and now you're homosexual. Ask yourself this question. If you had a daughter, would you trust your daughter then to marry that gentleman? Do you believe in an organization or something that could really change someone in that way enough to let your daughter enter into a marriage with that man, thinking that, well, that's going to be, or your daughter or your son to enter into a marriage? Do you believe in it enough at your core that folks could really change? And in the same way, do you think that you could join a group that could get you to change your heterosexuality into homosexuality? We're talking about the same thing. We're talking about changing the core of who we are. My mother asked me when I came out to her, she asked me all sort of the typical questions. She said, well, are you sure this just isn't a phase? This is just a little thing that you're going through, isn't it? Mom, I'm 20, and this is, you know, it's not a phase. And okay. She said, well, maybe you just need to meet the right woman. Maybe you haven't met the right woman yet. And I said, well, Mom, maybe you're right, and maybe my brother Mark just hasn't met the right man. No, if you would just meet the right man, and Steve, I bet he'd leave his wife if he met the right man. She's like, what are you talking about? And I said, I'm talking about exactly the same thing that you're talking about. She's like, oh, I just have so much to learn. It doesn't sound like a mother's.
So, Tim, to have other people talk, I was wondering if there's any parents in the room of gay individuals. A buddy of mine just found out that his daughter's gay, and he's ex-Green Beret, and his initial thing was shock. You know, he was like, whoa. You know, and he was like rolling his eyes because he was talking to me. And we just talked before I came up here. But I wonder if there's any parents in here or siblings of gay, and how you reacted and what that was like, if you want to share it.
Didn't bother me a bit. My sister's a lesbian. Mm-hmm. She hid it real well from me. She was living in a different town. And what dawned on me is suddenly going to her house and there's one bed, three bedrooms. It was like, oh!
How old was she when you found out from me about?
Let's see, she was 28. But she's not all the way one end of the spectrum. She started out with boyfriends and tried to suppress her sexuality. You know, her homosexuality, tried to suppress it by going out with guys. But it didn't work. It wasn't right. So she's been with a companion for 9 years.
That's interesting you brought this up because I had the privilege of going to Adams Morgan, the Miss Adams Morgan pageant, which is an area in D.C. that's a large gay population there. And the Miss Adams Morgan is a beauty pageant, and all the proceeds go to help benefit AIDS programs. and it's a drag queen pageant. But it was a really wonderful experience. But tying this all in right here, the winner at the end had his parents there, both his mother and his father. And they came up, and they were so proud of him, you could tell. And they were hugging him and kissing him. Even his sister was there, too. And the audience just stood up and cheered. And my husband was saying, his friend, he has a friend that's gay, and I'm learning more about the gay, you know, experience and everything through him. And he said, you don't know how much this means to a person that's a homosexual to have your parents actually support you like that, especially in the public area.
And my friend's still not out. Mm-hmm. He's out to his friends, but not to his folks.
I would open that up and say how much it means for anyone to have their parents support. But perhaps especially. Yeah?
Why do you suppose, in churches in particular, the issue of gay and lesbian is such a difficult one? I mean, why is it that organized religions have so much trouble with that? Do you think that as a population would be the group that would be most embracing and least troubled by that? And why are the breakthroughs so slow?
I want to jump into that conversation, but I think that's going to take us off into a conversation, and I don't want to miss any other folks that wanted to respond to Terry's sort of comment about parents or siblings or family. Any other comments about family? Then let's jump into the church. your question expressed questions that I have. I was very angry at the church for a long, long time because I thought, you know, the church should have been the one place I could have gone for support and understanding, or at least information. And my church, there was nothing said. It was what I call the conspiracy of silence. I'm going to talk about it. I never heard anything necessarily condemning, but I didn't hear anything that gave me any clue that would assist me in helping me discover, understand who I was. Why is it a struggle with the church? And to also, I think we need to keep the church in a time frame. It's a struggle with our church in this day and age. I think that, you know, there's the biblical question, the scriptural question, and there are a number of texts that many of us have probably heard over and over again. There are some wonderful books that address the scriptural context of some of the references to homosexuality, as well as a number of tapes in the Tate Ministry Library, because this conversation has happened many, many times, that can look and can bring us through the biblical scripture and look at each of the different texts that are commonly referred to. But the question that I really come down to, even beyond the scripture, is, as a church community, what does it say about us if we're not open to listening and hearing one another and supporting one another in our struggles, in our struggle to self-understand one another? So, well, I'm just going to leave that question there and sort of open it up and let some people respond as to why do you think it's a struggle in your church or in the church as a whole.
You made the comment it's only been 100 years, which there's been an identification of gay and lesbian situation. Mm-hmm. The Bible was written thousands of years ago.
Yeah. That's a beautiful segue into interpretation or translation. When we translate back from the original text of the Bible and try to put it into our English language, and what do we lose through that translation? And for example, the word in Greek that's used in the Sodom and Gomorrah story. Everyone's pretty familiar with Sodom and Gomorrah. It's translated in some texts is that the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah was homosexuality, that these men wanted to have sex with these other men. The word in Greek is exactly the same word as could be translated into inhospitality, to be inhospitable to one another. And it's a word that's defined by its context. So, is the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah that they were inhospitable? Or even if you went with the idea that it had to do with sexuality, it didn't talk about, it wasn't in reference to homosexuality. It didn't talk about homosexuality, someone who is gay. It talked about rape and abuse. men having sex with men, perhaps those men were heterosexual, and then, yeah, for them to go against their sexuality and try to have sex with other men would be wrong. But it was more about rape. Many of the references to homosexuality in Scripture isn't talking about a loving, committed relationship between two people of the same sex. They're talking about the core of who someone is as a gay individual. It's talking about promiscuity, it's talking about prostitution, it's talking about violence and rape. I don't even try to pass myself off as a biblical scholar, so those that have more information, please enter into the conversation.
I can't do a lot with the biblical stuff either, but the church always has one or two defining issues at any given time. And it's always a place where people feel there's a sense of safety in what has been. I mean, all the issues over music, all the issues over literal interpretation of scriptures in the 40s, I mean, there's been a lot of those types of issues. And I personally see this as that's where they're at now. This is going to be the issue for a while, as opposed to it being a defining issue that's totally different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're so traditionally based in my community, Southwest Washington. I was thinking how to just change from organ music to piano upsets a lot of people, you know? And so, yeah, and we had a couple of members who had AIDS, and I didn't feel a communal support for them. And it was sort of quietly talked about. And they died. And there's great sadness to that, you know? And so I was trying to get like a AIDS support group going in the church, but it was like, no, please not. You know, so I think the church is homophobic, and in my jurisdiction, in my area, I don't know. I'm not in San Francisco or something, but Southwest Washington, I think it's very homophobic stuff.
Other people,
I belong to a church in Spokane, Washington, and there's a joke in our church that says, "How many Lutherans does it take to change a light bulb?" In our church, our church population, 86% is over the age of 60. So we are a very old church, and even the word homosexuality, people run for the doors. And so I think you're going to have a whole new wave of people come through our church before you would even have an open discussion.
To clarify, over 60 isn't really old for some folks.
Older. Mature.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I think you have to understand that people over 60, we didn't deal with that problem because the problem wasn't there for us to see.
And for the tape, she's holding up her fingers in quotes. Wasn't there.
Well, I know I worked with lesbian women mm-hmm. who were definitely in the closet, who were not out of the closet in those days, in the 50s and 60s. So you didn't deal with the problem because it was not there, okay? Now, my daughter lived with two gay guys, so I had to deal with the problem right then and there. How did I react to this? One of the guys died of AIDS subsequently. So, you know, you have a certain amount of anxiety as a parent here as to, you know, where is my daughter coming from in all this? You know, where does she fit into this? You know, so, yeah, I don't say you don't learn things. It becomes a learning situation whether you like it or not. Whether you're 60 plus or not.
The church and our society has been very successful in suppressing this issue. You know, successful to the extent that, as a gay Christian, sometimes I've been kind of homeless because it's not real popular, you know, to be Christian in the gay lesbian community sometimes. And then, you know, I've struggled within the church too. And people are sort of like, why bother? You know? People are so closed-minded in their hatred, and you hear, why bother? And for a while, that was successful. I thought, I don't want anything, forget it. I can explore my spirituality. But now I've come back to the church and said, guess what? You get to deal with me, you know? And I think that's part of, I think that's God's work calling to gays and lesbians to call the church to say, hello. Mm-hmm. We're not just going to run away. We love this church as much as everyone else. And we're not just going to be pushed out of it anymore. We want to be a part of it as we're called to be. So, I think the challenge to that finally, you know, you might be able to talk to somebody who's sitting next to you in the pew who's comfortable letting you know that they're gay or lesbian, or their son is their daughter or nephew.
I don't think it's so much where you live as far as your church, how they deal with it, because I also live in southwestern Washington, and my church is probably half of the church is between 15 and 35, and I mean, I think we deal with change very well. I don't think it would be a real big issue if somebody, you know, came out and said that they were gay or lesbian, because I mean, the way that our church is, we're so open with each other, we're just like brothers and sisters, we're just like family to begin with, so mm-hmm. I just think it just depends on how your church handles mm-hmm. each other, not so much location and stuff.
I think Lutherans are nice, you know? We don't want to get into an argument with someone. Someone disagrees with us, so perhaps we don't discover that there's a lot of people that are sharing the experience with us.
How many think that their home congregation would accept a gay pastor?
How many think they would?
A gay pastor?
I see two hands go up.
An openly gay pastor or a gay pastor?
An individual known to be gay who's a pastor. Or a woman known to be gay who's a pastor. So we got about 4, 5, 6 hands, and we got about 25 no hands.
I wonder how many of those are Lutheran.
That's what I was going to say.
I'm
Lutheran.
Our church is an ELCA church in Maryland, and we have a sister church, which is the Episcopalian church. And, you know, we're talking about the Lutheran Episcopalian communal. That church is very gay, and the pastor is gay, and I remember, before I came out here, I was searching a website, and some guy in the church has a website talking about his affiliation with various gay causes and his relationship with the pastor. So they're very open about it. And our church is
the Presbyterian.
That's the Presbyterian church, but our church and our church is talking about more and more relationships with them. So it's an interesting experiment to see what's going to happen. Because we have an older congregation. Well, it's very mixed, but it's interesting to see. And, you know, you are asking a lot. Our church is going from not talking about sex at all to talking about homosexuality.
We're in an ELCA church, and the bishop, when the statement came out on sexuality, it was the bishop of the church at the time. We changed that, put out a tape, which explained it very, you know, just went through the issues. Mm-hmm. And I bought one and tried to show it at our church, and I couldn't even get to show it. Yeah. I mean, it was put out by the chief.
A couple of comments over here.
I think part of the issue, though, I have a seminary friend who was married and graduated, got a church, then came out. He and his wife divorced. And I think, I can't remember what he said, 25 families, or 25 individuals, I can't remember which number, left the congregation, and the rest of the congregation was very supportive of him. And I think if congregations experience that, then our hands would be different. But I think it's the whole notion that people don't understand, they don't know gay people, they don't know they know gay people, mm-hmm. and it's a scary thing. And the why, who knows the why, but I think if every Lutheran church, every ELCA church discovered their pastor was gay, there's no doubt that there would be a huge exodus from a set of the parishioners. But I would assume the majority, at least in each congregation, if they knew that person loved them as a pastor, then they could deal with it. I think that's the whole thing of overcoming this is being to know people. So it's wonderful that you do this, and you are articulate, and you do a fine job with this. And it's getting to know someone, and until this person was the first person I knew personally. Mm-hmm. And all the questions, you know, would you let this person babysit your child? That was really theoretical to me before. It's like, I don't know. I don't know any gay people. But yeah, Brad, he did watch our child. Mm-hmm. And I have no problem with it because I know Brad.
Right.
So I don't know a gay person. I know Brad, who happens to be gay.
Right.
And that changes, I think, one other direction, I think. Mm-hmm.
I'm not Lutheran, but I have a question. I don't know, within the Lutheran Church or any of the Protestant denominations, are there any Protestant denominations that the ruling bodies are ordaining pastors who are openly gay and lesbian?
Yeah, the Church of Christ.
Yeah. Well, the Lutheran Church does.
The Lutheran Church does if you sign off to being celibate.
Oh. Yeah.
So it's tradition.
Yeah, the UCC is probably...
But that's congregation to congregation. They don't have an overarching thing. So each congregation does what they please.
Makes their decision.
Yeah. I don't know what the other ones.
Methodists have been working on it, but they haven't gotten to that point yet.
Mm-hmm. Because to me, that seems to be a sticking point, is if we can't get the people who govern, you know, the churches to say, ordaining openly gay people is okay. I don't see how we can roll forward.
I think it's partly motivated by that fear of the great exodus. You know, if the ELCA was to all of a sudden, you know, make further acknowledgement. It's interesting that there's the fear of the exodus of supposedly heterosexual folks that would leave the church if the church was more supportive of the case. But yet it's been fine for the persecution and the pushing away of gays and lesbians from the church. We just don't know what those numbers are, because it's, you know, very early on you get the signals from your church and you say, forget it, you know, and we're not concerned about that.
But not that we should, but it's interesting, you know, all the Methodists, the Presbyterians, and the Lutherans, all within 5 to 7 years, put out sexuality statements. We were, the ELCA was the last one. But every one that did that, it was the exact same reaction. And every one of their publishing houses took big financial hits. And once again, not that this should be a reason, I'm just saying it is really a hot issue. Mm-hmm. And churches really, the hierarchy is just terrified to take it on because it just is such a firestorm when they do. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the big church can do. I really think the answer is individual congregations and individual people learning to deal with us on an individual basis, which unfortunately is going to be a terribly slow process.
One of the things that's happening in some of the churches in various denominations is you know, different terms are used, but it's open and affirming congregations or reconciling congregations, or a lot of different terms, but they're terms, I mean, they're congregations that open themselves up to including gay and lesbians as part of the community, you know, affirming that you have every right to worship with us and are part of the community. And the church I belong to in Seattle is a reconciling congregation within the Methodist Church. And I wasn't Methodist before, but I joined the church because of this. When the church first decided to become a reconciling congregation, it did lose members initially. It was not a particularly, it was an average-sized congregation. A lot of people been leaving over the years. You know, most churches in general, my father was head of the church council in Seattle in the 60s, and the church decline in church attendance during that time was just incredible. So, you know, a lot of churches had lost from the 50s a number of people in congregations, but this, you know, stimulated an exodus of about 25% of the church population. But what has happened in the meantime is that all those who have felt disenfranchised from the church because of their sexuality have said, I have a place to go. I have a place where I can know the love of other people, know that I'm accepted for who I am. I know that God loves me. And here's a congregation that's saying that that's true. And The church has grown about six or more times by the time I left, and it was still growing. We went to, from having, when I first joined it, several years after, they had become a reconciling congregation. From filling about half of the pews for one service a Sunday, we now have overflow of two services every Sunday. Families are joining because they, either because they're families that are half gay parents, and they want their children to be part of that kind of families, who also want their children to have that kind of open, you know, discussion and be able to be part of that kind of growth experience. The church is, in the average population is in its 30s. There are some older but very vibrant community members, and a large portion of it is families. So it's one of those things that, yes, you may initially lose some people, but in general, and I've heard the same thing from several other churches in the Seattle area that have, and also some churches in like southwestern Washington, where some of our pastors come from, that have had similar experiences there. After a year or two, and once word gets out, the churches actually start growing. And they grow with vibrant community.
My home parish in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Cross Lutheran Church, is a Reconciling Christ congregation. That's the Lutheran equivalent to Reconciling. Reconciling Christ is a program put out by Lutherans Concerned, which is a pan-Lutheran group that works for further understanding around gay and lesbian issues. There's some information on the red table there about it. There's over 120 congregations in the United States that are Reconciling Christ, which means they've accepted a statement that says that they're open for gays and lesbians to become full members of the congregation, just like everybody else. No special treatment. You know, you're just one of us. Thanks. That's what we've been asking for. My congregation in Milwaukee is an inner city congregation. It's 85% African American, 10% white, 15% Hispanic and Laotian, and a nice blend of folks. It took the congregation about a year to engage in study and to meet weekly talking about it, because we didn't want to just say, you know, we're open to gays and lesbians, and some folks never even heard the term. What are you talking about? We're out of here. So we were very very intentional in wanting to educate people. And let's talk about this. You get questions and concerns, let's air that. And then we did it as a congregational vote. The entire congregation was during our annual meeting there to vote. And it passed overwhelmingly. And five families left the congregation, and four of them returned. And the other one, the pastor says they were just waiting for it. and since then, the church has just really grown. You know, a lot of people thought, well, great, we're going to become, you know, just a gay church. And no, it's just a beautiful blend of people, and more folks have come in. The church has grown as a result. Other church, family, home church experiences and thoughts? Any other thoughts as to why this is a struggle for our church?
I've heard two different people express a couple of ideas that have been particularly interesting to me. One of them is a bishop in the ELCA who, bishops, I think, a lot of times feel torn about what to do when situations come up and how they can handle that. And he was feeling torn in that dilemma, and he remarked that it seemed to him like when Christianity, you know, those first couple hundred years when it was getting started, and that Christianity was really about the gospel and this good news that was kind of upsetting all of these societal institutions, you know, or at least, you know, challenging them in many ways. And that, you know, then we get Christianity nationalized as the official church with Constantine, and it gets very much tied in with the whole, with state governments, and everybody becomes Christian, and it's a big thing. And he was saying that now he really sees the church, you know, although we are trying to be about the gospel, the good news, in many ways,
he feels is, from the perspective of a bishop, that it's about maintaining the moral order, especially in the United States, that the church is expected by many people to maintain the moral standard. When everything else seems to be crumbling around us, the church is supposed to maintain some kind of, you know, status quo or moral order. I thought that was interesting to think about, at least. Just that's, pardon me, this church and morality.
I personally feel Christianity lacks a lot of morals through history. The problem with Christianity is, the failing point with a lot of Christians is we don't understand the Bible. We look at it simply as that's the word we follow, period. Nobody's ever exegetically sat down and looked at the, it's a book, that's all it is. You know, there's five stories intertwined in two sentences, that's what the book is. Reading the book for that makes you a stronger Christian. When you're just taking, believe that you should be a Christian because that's what your parents told you should do. Feel you're a weaker Christian than somebody who actually challenges what the Bible says.
Mm-hmm. I don't think that he would certainly not disagree with that from his perspective. It's more about a certain kind of a Greek moral consensus or something in society that shouldn't change too quickly or something along that line. So it was interesting to think about for me anyway. And then the second thing was a master's thesis that a friend of mine did where he that dealt particularly with why is this a big issue in the ELCA in particular. And he, in his thesis, had gone back and done a lot of research about the founding of the ELCA back in, was that 1987, 88, right in there? And that coincided, the founding of the ELCA coincided with one thing in particular was three gay men coming out at PLTS in Berkeley, and they had already been approved for ordination, and now the church had three openly gay men who were approved for ordination, and this church was just, you know, this combined Lutheran church was just coming into existence, and he was able to document how these two issues unfortunately got really linked in a very fundamental founding point in the ELCA's history in a lot of ways, that the national church had to define itself in terms of where its position was going to be on this by then creating a document regarding ordination, and the three men, their approval was then taken away. So that was another point I thought about how some of these things get linked together.
I think there's also a bit of, as a society and as an individual, I admit, I'll look at times and somebody else say, you know, because you're different, I don't like you. And we've always had that as a society. They, you know, your race, your religion, or anything else. So here's another way of differentiating you and then categorizing and pushing you away. Because, see, you know, I can push you away and I feel better about myself, sort of deal. I wonder if that's part of this discussion now. But as more people come at it, we more discuss it, there's more acceptance. Mm-hmm. But we're still a long way from there. For the progress we talk about, legislation is not occurring as quickly as many people would like. And I mentioned it earlier this week, but UW University of Washington put out a same-sex policy as far as health care and benefits. And the reaction at the Republican-controlled legislature in Washington was some of them were like, how do we cut funding to UW, you know? That was a little reactionary, and they can't do it. But, you know, that's how supportive some segments of the legislature are. But it's at all levels, I think.
I mean, the comment is when people come out, there's more acceptance. Maybe true, but there's also an incredible increase of gay bashing and people being beat up and killed simply because of who they are, losing their jobs, being kicked out of their churches, being disowned from their families. So there's a darker side of the process as well.
Thanks for bringing that up, because Oregon has these initiatives that kept coming up that would have penalized same-sex relationships, mm-hmm. and prohibited certain activities or involvement by them in things. And I thought, what a deal to be an American citizen, you know, which has some rights to it, and to feel under attack, you know? I came from Irish Catholic background. What if they started saying, you know, Irish Catholics, you know, you can't own land, you know? I mean, but you can come here, but don't own land.
And we used to do that with the African Americans, you know, mm-hmm. as a traditional deed restriction.
Yeah.
What a deal.
Congregations that become reconciled congregations, how does that happen? How did it happen in your congregation?
My congregation, we chose to engage in a study. The church council brought it to the congregation, the pastor, and just said, we want to start, this is going to be the adult forum topic each week. And so we had that conversation and went on. And then we decided to do it as a full congregational vote at our annual meeting, and the congregation voted. I've heard of it being done in different ways. One way in which the church council begins that study and then makes a vote, or the church council just votes. So it can be done in any sort of way. Now after it happens, the church is then registered. The Lutherans Concern does a publication called The Concord, and it lists all congregations as sort of a national directory for folks. So if I move to Spokane, I could look in the Lutherans Concern newsletter to see which church is reconciling Christ, which church has said that they're open to gays and lesbians. I've made the personal commitment that I will never be a member of a Lutheran church or a church that isn't going to accept me completely for who I am. I can bring my God-given gifts, talents, and my money elsewhere. And I feel the same way about any sort of job or work experience or where I live. Golden Village has got an equal opportunity statement, and I wouldn't be here if it didn't have it. So I feel very given about that. So there's a number of different ways of engaging in it, but then it says a public notice about that folks are welcome here.
That's outside of the ELCA, though, headquarters. I mean, that's not...
Well, it's right. It's not an official ELCA-sanctioned thing, but we're good friends. Lutheran's Concern, I mean, you know, works closely with the church. It's a called a PAM.
But they're not a group out of Chicago. Is that connected with the church itself?
No. Not connected to it. Did that answer your question completely?
Well, it did, partially. I'm just thinking, you know, who gets that going in a church? Is it a parent of a gay person? Is it a gay person themselves?
That is the question. Who is going to get it going?
Anyhow.
I tell you, it's difficult to do if you don't have a supportive pastor. It can be done. But I think, you know, you got to have some support. You spoke of just wanting to show a video and folks would, you know, allow that. So it really, you know, where is the cult power in the congregation? Where is the leadership in the congregation? So it varies. But Lutheran's Concern has some publications about reconciling Christ. They produced a study called Can We Talk About This? Can We Talk About It? It's over there on the table. They have a cassette tape. That's the study that we partly used. Sort of a leadership of that.
Can I change topics a little bit?
Sure. We're pretty close to winding down.
Yeah. You said you do these on a frequent basis.
Yep.
How many dissenting voices do you hear? Has it gotten pretty small?
Well, there's, you know, there's usually a few.
I guess what I'm trying to get at is I'm concerned it used to be, I'm sure what you're mostly used to, in most places, if you're in the country and this topic came up, you'd be the one under attack.
Mm-hmm.
And then the rest would sit around here and feel very good about themselves because we were all bashing the gays like God wants us to, right? Mm-hmm. I fear the pendulum has swung so far here, though, that if anyone spoke up, and no one has here, and that doesn't mean there isn't dissenting opinions here, but no one has spoke, which they're welcome not to. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering if people, when they hear the announcement, we're going to have this discussion, if it's mostly people like myself who I'm not dissenting, so I want to come and learn more.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder if a dissenting person really feels welcome here anymore.
And that's not, you know, I try to, you know, my opening comments and statements, I try to be as open to that and trying to
It was not even once you get here, though. Somehow, I'm just afraid. A lot of people come to Holden because there's, you know, the pushing the envelope stuff we want to talk about. Mm-hmm. A lot come here because it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. And they don't care less what takes place in these buildings, mm-hmm. which, once again, is their privilege.
Yeah.
But I think there's really a chance to do some education. Yeah. But I think it's almost more scary here to be on the, you know, on the conservative side, if you want to use that language, than the other side. And so those people aren't coming to these things and listening and hearing. I don't know how Holden can somehow encourage
that more. You know, we've got a section in the bookstore. We hold the information in the resource center. I can tell you that when I do these sessions, it usually leads to at least probably 10 hours of conversation in the following few days of folks that will come to me and say, "Oh, I didn't want to come to your session, but let me tell you what I think." Or, you know, can we talk a little more about that? And I also want to open myself up to that I want to be available for conversation at any time during your stay. Please just pull me aside and let's go for a walk or whatever and talk more about it. But that is a concern. Each time the session sort of winds down, I've sat in too many groups and not felt comfortable expressing my views or even expressing who I am. And I hate for anyone to walk away with that feeling, but I'll end with my encouragement to say, this isn't the end of the conversation. This isn't the end of the dialogue. You know, for some folks, maybe this is the beginning. For others, it's just another, you know, time to chat. But to go out, and I think the worst thing that can happen is that we don't talk about it, and that we're just quiet about it. If you have views that are differing, you know, be able to express those. Not just to hold on to them, but to bring those out too in conversation, and challenge yourself to have a conversation with someone that might disagree with you. You know, that's part of the sort of adrenaline that starts to flow for me every time I do this. I think, okay, there's going to be hopefully, you know, a few folks in there that I can have an exchange with. I've spoken to lots of congregations out in Milwaukee. It was part of the Lutherans Concerned Group there. People would call from the church and say, "Well, our church wants to talk about this, and you know, could you come out and be the gay person at your church?" "Well, why doesn't someone in your congregation who's gay or lesbian speak?" "Oh, we don't have anyone." Context in which to, you know, enter the conversation.
Yep.
And I get a lot out of that sort of exchange, and I hope that anybody would, because the real challenge is for me not to is for me to accept and respect the other person's opinion, but also encourage them to own it and to discover where it comes from. As much as I need to discover where my thoughts and my beliefs come from about who I am and about who I believe God is. So that we need to take an individual responsibility to question, how is it that, you know, have I just heard conversation about Scripture and I've jumped on board about that, either pro or against, or do I know what those passages refer to? Do I know what those words mean? Do I know the historical part, you know, of that? Have I met anyone who's gay? Where do I have these thoughts and feelings about gay folks? Is it related to my own thoughts, or, you know, so it's that sort of, that's how I've done conversations when, if it was to be a room full of people, quote, against me as an openly gay man, I feel safe and secure enough about who I am to encourage people to look at their own thoughts and challenge themselves, and then continue on in the conversation. And all we can do is be open and available for conversations. That's all we really can do, aside from dragging people in, I suppose. So thanks for spending the time here, and please keep talking about it. I do want to end, I already ended, but I'll end a second time with my comment, and it's this. I heard Herb Chilstrom say at a conference I was at in March in Ann Arbor, talking about the church. Herbert Chilstrom now does a lot of traveling and talks about the gay and lesbian issue, and he's supportive in encouraging people to study more and learn more about it. And he said that it's taken him 20 years to come to a better understanding about homosexuality. And he would use the phrase, "The wheels of change move slowly, we need to, this is going to take a long time, just sort of, it moves slowly, and I would just get infuriated when he would say those terms, because he would say it so casually, and even this idea of like, well, it's going to take the church a while. The image that I keep in my mind is that these wheels might move slowly, but they need oiling. And what oils the wheels? It's the blood of gay and lesbian youth that are 6 times more likely to kill themselves, to commit suicide, because they don't have a place to go. They don't have anyone that understands. They don't understand themselves. So it may move slowly, but we can do our part to help them move along a little bit, to open the conversation up, to use the word gay and lesbian in the next week or in the next day, you know? To just talk about all that fire chief I was holding, you know, we went and we heard the session about gay. Pretty soon someone will hear you say that and go, wow, maybe that's a person I can go talk to about my daughter. But that it is a matter of life and death that this conversation goes on. I thank God that I wasn't successful with my thoughts and attempts of suicide when I thought I had no place else to go. So whether we agree or disagree, we must agree on the importance of at least talking about it and giving people a chance to try to talk about the questions that they have, rather than turning to killing themselves. So I'll end with that happy note, huh? Thanks for being here.